It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Once upon a time, there was a pretty fly. He had a pretty wife, this pretty fly. But one day she flew away.
How many's the time poor brother Ben told me about these youngins?
What'd he tell you?
He told me lots and lots of things.
The night before your father died, he told me what he did with that money.
He said, you tell my little girl Pearl that there's to be no secrets between her and you.
The children know where it's hid. John knows.
Where's the money hid?
I don't know nothing. You think you can make me tell, but I won't! I won't! I won't!
Leaning on the everlasting.
Come on, Pearl!
I can feel myself getting awful mad. Aren't you afraid, little lambs, down there in all that dark?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am here with my very good friend, and I, to the best of my knowledge, not a serial killer, Mr. Sean Whalen.
At least not today. It's a pleasure to be here today.
That's when we were talking about Star Trek one time, Andy Leyland said, you know, something about, you know, that when they were talking about humans as compared to the other races, I choose not to kill today. How you doing?
I am good. This is going to be an interesting film to talk about because this is clearly something I never would have seen if we weren't doing this podcast. And you hadn't mentioned to me, hey, I watched this film. You want to talk about it? So this is one of those, but I think it's fun to do a podcast like this for these type of movies.
Yeah, well, I mentioned in the past that, you know, what I'm trying to do is when I get the chance, I go on to TCM, Turner Classic Movies, and I start going forward on their calendar to see if there's a movie coming up that either I've heard good things about over the years and have never seen, or I saw, but it's so long ago that I really want to see it again. And I set the DVR for them. And I get a number of them set up, and then I wait, you know, after they record. I don't want to overwhelm my DVR, so I wait until I watch a few of them, and then I delete. And as I delete, then I go back in and I record some more. So this is one that I did that way, and it's Night of the Hunter from 1955. I had always heard the name, and I had heard Robert Mitchum played a great villain in this movie. Wow. That was pretty much all I ever heard. I hadn't really heard any of the story beats or details, or any of the background stuff. So I went into this pretty clean, and I watched it, and I don't want to go as far as to say I was blown away, but let's just say I was very impressed. And then I watched it a second time, and I was like, Sean, we got to do this one. So, you know, I guess I'm giving away my thoughts right away by saying that I was impressed by it. But
I think the interesting part of this one is to talk about how we got there. Cause I'm very much in a similar place. I watched this one based on your recommendation, like, hey, you should watch this. This might be something we want to talk about. So typically you're not throwing me something that's god awful. Although admittedly, that would also be something interesting to talk about.
Well, if I watch one that I believed was god awful, I probably would give you a forewarning on it and say, I watched this one and I was amazed at how bad it was. Are you interested in covering it? No, this one, I really like this. And to be honest with you, I've now seen it 3 times and I liked it more each time I saw it. Mm-hmm. So, this movie, you know, right off the bat, this was directed by Charles Laughton. It's the only movie that was ever directed by Charles Laughton. And that is a real shame because the problem is that it did not perform well in the box office. He was very disheartened by that fact. And because of all of that, he didn't want to deal with that again. And I can only imagine the amount of himself that he put in this, you know, just to plan it and to get everything done and to finally get this thing to the screen and then to have it bomb in the box office. It had to be a huge disappointment for him. And looking back, it's really a shame because this is so well directed. This has a very, it is somewhat unique to his style, but it has a Hitchcockian feel to me. You know, there's definitely a lot of thought that went into the camera angles that are taken, and the, you know, the different shots and everything. And there's a lot to it. What I'm trying to remember what they call the style that he had with the you know, the angles and all of that. All of a sudden, I'm drawing a blank on that.
So visually, this movie is captivating. I mean, he did a lot of things in this film that just kept it gripping. So I'm with you. The terminology is escaping me too, but it's one of the pieces over this is how the set pieces were framed. It's funny. There's distance shots that are very compelling with Powell on a horse, and that wasn't Powell. Mm-hmm. They actually used, and forgive me on the terminology for this one, but they used a dwarf on a horse in the background to give you that that sense of perspective, which was an interesting, I thought, because the shadowed sequence of him in the distance often added to the fear factor of this. One thing I liked about this one is it was a thriller that had a scary villain, but it's not like it's something you can watch with an audience that doesn't like scary movies, if that makes sense.
There are no jump scares.
Yes, but yet he's a compelling villain. And I thought the sequences where, like, he just keeps coming. He just keeps coming. And you hear him singing in the distance and stuff like that were framed up so well. And I think that's the cinematography in this was great. One of the things that Laughton interviewed about was that when it comes to this film, he liked theater better because of the fact that he could go back and course correct, you know, change lines and things like that if one night doesn't go well or something like that. And when you're on film, you're like stuck with what you've got. And I so wish that, like you, that he'd done more films, because this is really, it's everything I love about live theater. And I'm not saying this is live theater, but I'm saying it's that sensibility in this. And I think he's just a very talented filmmaker. And I think there's a reason this became a cult classic, because that's what ended up happening in this film's journey. And I could see how, like, all of a sudden it develops this cult classic audience and then gets really appreciated years later for what it was. Ebert wrote a really great review about this film as well. as just being one that you need to see. And I get why he loved it because of it. This is a visually stunning film because of the fact that I think you're right. The way the camera work was done in this one, there are so many shots that just set mood and tone in a way that this is something different. And it feels different. I like that part. This has its own unique flavor to it. It's his stamp. You know, as a director, you see somebody that if he had done more films, you'd almost do a study of his films, because I have a feeling he would keep growing with that along the way if he'd had the opportunity to do more. I would have liked to seen what his follow-up would have looked like, learning what he did from this film, like where he would have gone, because I feel like, my gosh, out of the starting gate, this is interesting to talk about. It would be interesting to see 3-4 films down the road what this guy had done.
Yeah, I think as best as I can tell, and you know, I mentioned Hitchcock earlier, and I think similar to Hitchcock, I think that Lawton seized upon the stylistic feel of the silent movies, so that while the dialogue is critical to the movie, the images are as well. He marries them really, really well. What I was looking to say before, because I just looked at the Wikipedia page, said Lawton drew on the harsh, angular look of the German expressionist films of the 1920s. And that's what I was trying to come up with before, that I couldn't come up with that term, the German expressionist movies. But there's scenes in it, and I'm going to seize on one that when I first watched the movie, I thought it was a negative. And then the subsequent viewings of it, I really, really liked. And it's when he goes down into the basement and then the kids have the shelf fall on him and then they run away and he comes up the stairs after them and he's got his arms outstretched. And it's a very, very clumsy look as he's going up the stairs. And it's very much like the Frankenstein monster as he looks. And like I said, the first time I saw it, I thought, well, that just doesn't look right. But then when I watched it again, I thought it really does emphasize his just his villainy, and as you said, that he just keeps coming. So I, you know, like while it bothered me, then I started to love it.
One of the things that I love about what you're saying right now is it frames up what I love about so many of the characters in this, but him in particular. There are masks on people, and his whole preacher persona and the way he interacts and the way he uses that to manipulate people is an example of, you know, like his view on religion. He's developed his own story that he almost believes in himself, as far as his relationship with God and religion and his serial killer ways. And when you see him in those moments without the mask, where he's desperate, you see it with the gunshot later, you know, when she shoots him, it's almost cartoony the way that he reacts. You see the cowardice, you see, you know, kind of just all of that mask pulled away. I loved that sequence up the stairs because it's no longer this confident, I'm selling everybody on my preacher persona and I'm holier than everybody else. And he uses that when he walks in. He walks in with an attitude that he's better than everybody else and selling them completely on that belief that he is a next level person. Even when he describes his tattoos, the way that he does it, he's always talking down to everybody. And he does it in such a way where it's not off-putting. You can see why people would be compelled towards him, but it's clear what he's doing. That's the sleight of hand with him. He walks in and tells them everything they're doing wrong. And, you know, he's going to come in and make the town a better place, and just his presence being there. And I love how everyone, when he shares his sensibilities, all of a sudden skirt towards the line of, oh, this is this holier than thou person. We, you know, boy, he's finally saying the things we all should be saying, and he's bringing them into the town, and nobody's actually paying attention to anything he's doing other than that. It works really well for him. Because he is the consummate shell game. Look over here at everything I just sold you. Ignore everything else I'm doing every other time. Nobody actually asks how he's raising the kids. Are the kids happy? Any of that stuff. They just naturally assume they are in the best possible position because they're with this wonderful preacher.
And he's a man of God.
Yes. I mean, and he's sold them so much on that, that like, how could he is such a good man for what he's taken on that any inkling of anything other than that is immediately dispelled because it can't possibly be that way because of this man. And oh my gosh, you should appreciate the fact that this man is even in your life. I love what he's crafted here. And it's all very, very believable. But I think the stare moments that you're talking about is where we see the real man. The man underneath even the lie that he's told himself. And it's great to see those moments. We see it again with the gunshot. When she shot him, there is a sequence when she shoots him where you see that same sort of visual on him. And it's almost like all pretense is dropped in those moments. That's where I thought on this one, wow, he really did a great job as an actor in portraying the multiple facets of the personality of this character. Because I loved those sequences. You're right. It's not the first viewing. It was my second viewing. It was very different for this film because I noticed things that I didn't see in the first viewing and appreciated even more the portrayal of this character that Robert Mitchum did. He said that this was his favorite role later on in life, which is, I get why. And this was his favorite director to work with.
Yeah. And again, I can't emphasize enough how much of a shame it is that Lawton didn't make more movies. I think his personality comes out a little bit right from the start, because when he's driving in the stolen car that he eventually gets arrested for, he's talking to God. He's not putting on a show for anybody. He thinks he's a messenger of God carrying out God's will. Then he's in whatever, the strip show or whatever. And he's, you know, how should I handle this, God? You know, what should I do to, you know, he's a serial killer and he's insane, but he's not, in his mind, he's not evil. He's carrying out God's will. And I've often said that I think that some of the best, just villains, whether it's in literature, movies, comic books, whatever, are the ones who think that they're the hero of the story. And he thinks he's the hero of this story. And he's, in his own way, he's terrifying because he's so creepy. But like you said, it's not something where he's necessarily scary to the viewer. Like, you're not sitting there on the edge of your seat like he's going to get you. But I could see you going to bed at night and having a nightmare about him coming to get you.
Ben Harper, the character Ben Harper, had this line, "What religion you profess, preacher?" And he comes back with, "The religion the Almighty and me worked out betwixt us." And I think that does sum him up. He knows that he doesn't fall into any of the other established religions. He does believe he has a relationship with God, and that relationship somehow justifies everything that he's doing. It just shows that he is a very twisted man. And he believes it so much so that the town believes in him too, which is interesting. They don't know he's a serial killer, just to be very clear off of that piece. But they do believe that he is this very chaste religious man. And that's what we'll talk about Willa and that's when she, and how she comes to all of this. Cause we have to talk about her, but you see how him entering into people's lives and being more ingrained into it. He is a very powerful presence. And if he's not the actor portraying this, and you don't have somebody of his caliber portraying this character, you lose this film, I think. You've got to build the film around him first and foremost. And the nice part about this film is all this drooling I'm doing about his acting portrayal, he's got a great cast with him in this film.
Yeah, we're going to have to get to some of those people. But pointed out there, the movie did bomb in the box office initially, but it, in retrospect, it was, you know, people discovered it. It's almost the evil version of It's a Wonderful Life, where it did badly in the movies, in the theater, but then eventually people realized that this is a classic. The American Film Institute ranked this as number 34 all time I think, as far as thrill movies. And they ranked Preacher Henry Powell as villain number 29 in their top 100 villains of all time. I don't know when that list came out. I don't know if anybody else would push him back a little bit more since then. But it just shows you, you know, that how highly this was thought of once people had a chance to really consume it. People, I think, are much more knowledgeable, or it is much better known. Robert Mitchum in Cape Fear, the villain he played in that movie. And that was a chilling performance, no question. But I think this one actually blows it away. I think this is a far superior, far more layered character. That guy in Cape Fear just felt like he was just kind of insane. This guy has levels of creepiness to him that you don't see in Cape Fear. Cape Fear, he's more of a force of nature. In this, he thinks he's directed by God to do these things, and he just keeps coming. Just by the way, if anybody hasn't watched this, I'm telling you now, you really should. It's available, very easy to watch. But we're going to spoil some things about it, because just story-wise, Peter Graves plays a small part in it, and he has robbed, he has $10,000. This is in the time of the Great Depression, so $10,000 is a huge amount of money. And before the police come and get him, he hides the money with his children, his two children, and he makes them promise and swear that they'll never tell anybody where the money is. He goes to jail, and he ends up sharing a cell with Reverend Powell, played by Mitchum, and he lets him know that somehow that he has the money, or that he had the money, but he doesn't tell him where it is. So when Mitchum gets out of jail, he immediately travels to the town, and he wins over some of the town people with his preacher persona. He ends up marrying the mother of the two children, and then spoilers, guys. He marries and kills the mother of the two children, and then he terrorizes the two children to try and get the money. And I'll leave it at that for now. The mother of the two children is Willa, and she's played by Shelley Winters. Very, very different from the Shelley Winters we saw in Poseidon Adventure. And I think she's a character that you need to see through the lens of when this movie is supposed to take place. Because when you're watching it, she's so docile, and she just allows things to happen that you say, you know, that's just not realistic. It almost feels like she's mentally challenged, that she's so docile to allow things to happen. But I think the reality of it is, at the time that this movie was filmed, and even before that, when the movie was supposed to take place, women of her stature were uneducated people, and they were expected just to take care of the home, and they weren't expected to be sophisticated. That's probably the environment that this character grew up in, you know, and she's doing what's expected of her to her detriment. And when you look at it from that perspective, I think her performance is really good in this movie, because she's resistant, but then she goes along with it, and there's a lot, you know, there are layers to that performance as well. And I really feel like it would be easy to overlook her.
You mentioned Peter Graves before, and I want to go back to that for just one second leading into this, because I think they're critical that they go together. In order to appreciate her character, you really need the establishment of what Peter Graves did in the very beginning. You've got to believe that this man, yes, he's a thief. Yes, he's willing to kill others to get the money. He is willing to do bad things because of the fact that he wants to give things to his family. The desperation of making sure that the kids wind up hiding the money and they don't tell anybody, so that way it's their legacy. This was somebody, he's not doing it for him. If he was doing it for him, there'd be that selfish kind of, I've got to hide it somewhere so I can do it. And how am I going to escape from this hanging that they're going to do with me? There's none of that. He's accepted his fate. He knows he's done. And his whole thing is, I've got to leave this for my kids. Don't even tell your mom at that moment. But what's clear with him is, even with his wife, who I really do believe he loved in his own way, he gave, and she references it later. This is guilt. So the docile piece that you're talking about, where it works for me so well with her, if you establish the fact that this woman now has a lot of reason to feel guilt because of the fact that her husband now is being hung. A lot of the pressure on the husband came from her too, because she wanted stuff and she knew this man was doing bad things and knew that he was making sure she had nice things, because she references it later in the film, you know, when she's trying to be this better person because of the fact that she's with the preacher now, that she's like testifying to the public that I wanted nice things. I pressured my husband to do these horrible things in order to get these nice things. I'm a sinner like you're sinners. She starts like trying to be this better person because she's drinking the Kool-Aid. I actually love that this docile character comes from a guilt perspective that I think works really well from her. And she wound up being, for the period that she's in the film, an interesting and compelling role, because you see how survivor's guilt, especially when your spouse has done horrible things and you feel like on some level you are responsible and should have somehow intervened and stopped all of that, just plays into this. I thought that part of the layers of this is really strong. It's a strong character, even though you're right. Everything you said before, yeah, and set the time period and all that, it's more of a docile character. I do love that even with that, it's not your traditional single-layered, meek, like, woman. There's layers to her that when you really watch this film are pretty interesting for the time, that I thought were pretty cool.
I agree. And, you know, again, like as you say, there's layers, and I think she's a more complex character than she appears on the surface. And I think part of that is the influence of others on her. You know, you have Henry Powell, who's pushing her towards this thing, and it ends up making her, like you say, she's like testifying, "I did evil, I did this, whatever." But you also have her contemporaries. You have Icy Spoon, who's an interesting character unto herself, who's pushing her to marry Powell. You know, you don't let him get away, that kind of thing. So, you know, she's got the peer pressure. She's got everything going on. And again, she's not a sophisticated or very smart woman. And she's certainly an uneducated woman. So she kind of goes along with it. And then when he eventually kills her, she just kind of accepts what's going to happen. She's extremely docile. She doesn't fight it in the slightest. So, you know, there's layers there. Icy Spoon is interesting to me because while she's annoying for the position she takes, she plays the part well. That's Evelyn Vardin is the actress. And she reminds me in her own way, you know, we've done a couple of the Universal monster movies, and I've talked about like the innkeeper's wife, who's a screaming, you know, marionette who's annoying. She reminds me of those characters if they weren't screaming and annoying, but the same kind of personality to her. So I think, you know, they wrote her a little bit more complex than that. But then when things happen at the end, she turns on him in a heartbeat, and she's calling for him to be strung up and taken out. So, you know, definitely cool stuff.
What was interesting with her is her husband was bringing up some questions that he had, and she was all in on the preacher until it was undeniable that he was evil and that he did something wrong. Then you're right. She flipped. And when she flipped, it was a like she was leading the charge. She almost had the torch up herself and was like running down the street. And she was a great character. And I love your comparison to the Universal Monster ones, because I think you're right. It's absolutely that character. I actually love that she isn't the screamer like that. It's not so over the top, because I think every town has those people. And in everybody's life, you have those people that are the busybodies that like to tell you how you should be living your life. And they're all in on it. And don't let go. Like, when they've got their opinion, doesn't matter what facts that they're given, they will not bend from those facts that are being put in front of them. And she did not. Like, her husband, I loved the sequence with her husband because it was subtle, but he was bringing up a few questions he had about what was going on, and she immediately dismissed them, which I think added to the character of Harry Powell. As far as world building goes, this is something this film does really well. You could very much make this very focused on Harry Powell, and everybody else is super secondary. They weren't. They were ingrained in, I think, building this villain in a way that worked really well. And I thought those sequences with the two of them further added this whole thing of how compelling he was and captivating he was to people through the interactions. I loved her as a character. I thought she was great in this. I didn't make the Universal Monster comparison until you said it. And I love that comparison. I think it's a great one.
So now I do think that this movie, you know, again, it's weird. I was going to say, I think this movie would have failed. Actually, it did fail, unfortunately, but that was because people didn't give it the opportunity, I'm sure. But I think this movie would have failed on a critical level if you didn't have the right two children playing the parts of the two children, because children actors, you know, they're hit and miss. Either you get a good performance, and it's probably a very low percentage of the time that you get a really solid performance, or you get a very stiff just reading of lines. We don't get that in this movie. Both children, particularly Billy Chapin as the son, give a strong performance in this. And they are compelling and they are likable, and their actions are, you know, they make sense. Pearl Harper, the Sally Jane Bruce is the actress, the young, very young girl, and the way she all of a sudden takes to Powell, she starts calling him Daddy Powell, and she's hugging him, and she thinks she loves him, but she's also loyal to Billy, who swore to his father that he'd take care of his sister, so he's watching out and trying to make sure that things are going the right way. There's layers to their performances, and for children actors, for Lawton to have pulled that out of them, I mean, that speaks volumes.
What was great about John and Billy's portrayal of John was from the second that Harry shows up on the scene, he's immediately suspecting him. He knows what his father told him, and he went all in on that. This is a kid who loved his dad and listened to what his dad said. It's probably a good thing dad wasn't around, you know, because of the fact that John, if he kept going the path of following dad, may have gone to a life of crime just because, you know, dad clearly had a major impact on him. So, you know, probably the best thing for this kid is where his life path led to him. But he does love his sister. He was told by his father to protect his sister and remains protective of her because she's very innocent and young. And honestly, she's everything that Harry hates. You know, when you think about it, like I feel like this girl's not long for the world because he slips with her. And I love those sequences where she's captivated by him and loves the initial attention because he's being manipulative of her. And I love her accent, the way that she says Pearl, I think was super cute and cool. She did not feel like a kid who was acting. She felt like this kid. John felt like John.
Yeah.
And that's something for child actors to be able to pull that off. I think back to a kid, some of my favorite shows as a kid, like I loved weird comparison. I loved Will Robinson and Lost in Space. I loved the Lassie, you know, elements like with Timmy and, you know, the Lassie TV show and stuff like that with kids in those. I think these kids go on a journey at a certain point. This is a film where all of a sudden it turns onto this survival film for these two kids where they're on the boat journey. And the musical score is kind of, you know, they're going down the river and you see the musical score going in that. This survival thing with the kids, if you don't like these kids, if you don't like adore these kids at this point and believe in them, that sequence loses something. I wanted these kids to get away from this man. And it wasn't just that he was a compelling villain. It was that I liked the kids at this point. I wanted to see the kids get the one up on him. It added to him because they were so good. And you're right. If you don't get that, if that casting was two different kids who just couldn't pull it off as much, this is a very different movie. And I loved the kids. I thought the portrayal of both of them was really, really great. Pearl's innocence was captivating. And John's relentless sticking to the plan. And he was so driven by it that when he eventually does break down later in the film, you believe it because of how relentless he was throughout the film to stick to what his father told him. And I just loved that portrayal.
Agreed, totally. So, I mean, I guess there's two other performances, one small and one big, that I want to make mention of. The first one is the small one, James Gleason as Uncle Bertie Steptoe. He's a red herring. he's Scatman Crothers in The Shining, mm-hmm. where, you know, you think he's going to be the savior for the kids, and he just isn't, because when Powell kills Willa, he straps her into a car and puts the car at the bottom of the lake that's there, and so that she won't, you know, she won't be found. But Uncle Bertie Steptoe, who has told the kids, anything goes wrong, you come to Uncle Bertie, he'll help you, he'll take care of you. And he's fishing and he sees her down there. And he's terrified that if he says anything, he's going to be blamed for the murder, which is pretty stupid, really. But, you know, he's, again, you know, these are not necessarily sophisticated people. And he ends up going on a bender so that when the kids finally are trying to get away from Powell, he's drunk and can't help them, and they have to just keep going. So it's an interesting little, again, kind of a red herring that they throw in there for you with him. But, you know, kind of cool to see, because you're thinking, okay, here's something where he's going to help them. And he doesn't do anything for them.
Here's the part where I'm with you. I think his whole thing is stupid, but I do think Powell would have used that against him.
Yeah, probably. I think you're probably right.
The sequence where he discovers her under the water, it was a very chilling sequence. This is an example of where black and white lighting and cinematography shine as well. That was a creepy sequence without being over the top. Like, it looked realistic. Like, this is what it would look like. It was her hair, the way it was flowing. And there was just something so creepy about. They didn't need to show it, but I'm glad they did. Because it added to the sense of, this is something that Powell has done over and over again. And we need to believe that as the viewer, and just how cold he was about all of this. I think leaving that nebulous in this film would not have worked. I think you needed to see what Powell did to set the stage for where the second act go, or the next act afterwards goes. Because it added more of a sense of danger for the kids when you see the mom and you actually see, oh my gosh, he really did this. And if he did this to her, because he almost didn't need to do it. Mom was on his side. But he did that because of his whole belief and the fact that he is a serial killer. They were all going to be dead no matter what. Like, all three of them, Powell's plan was he was going to eventually get the money. All three, the kids were going to die and she was going to die. That was just going to wait. I think that's the way this was all going to play out no matter what. Because he even references in the beginning of the film another widow. So this is something with widows. He's done this more than once. as far as his religion, his justification for what he does. So I don't know how he kills her and doesn't eventually kill the kids too. Just with using his twisted logic as far as how he operates, and how he turns on Pearl, I think was one of those things. So that sequence I thought was beautifully framed. In its horror, it was a beautiful horror sequence, and not over the top, but really added a chilling sense. Bertie was an interesting character because there was that part of me, I used the Lassie reference earlier. I thought he was going to somehow like be the savior for the kids, you know, and he was going to, you know, this was going to be a thing where they, the role that we get later on when they're adopted by the woman, the old woman who takes them in for the foster situation. I thought that was going to be him. I thought he was going to do that. I thought they were setting that up earlier in the film. I love that they didn't do that because it's almost, I like that the film did some twists and turns where you thought it was going to do one thing and then it went and did another. And I thought that's something also it did very well. It's not as stuck being as linear as you would think. You know, there were some twists and turns along the way that I think just made this a more compelling film. Bernie was one of them for me.
Yeah, I agree. I guess the last performance I want to touch on is, you mentioned the woman who takes them in eventually when they're on the run. You know, they're on the run and you see how just, you know, bad things are. You know, they're lucky that a woman gives them each a potato to eat. And it's a raw potato, and that's what they have as a meal, you know, over the course of however long that goes on. And they end up being taken in by Lillian Gish, who is a silent movie actress who started apparently in 1912, according to a Wikipedia entry. And she is, you know, older. I don't know if she's, you know, people appeared differently back then. So I don't know if she's elderly or if she's just older. She might be younger in this movie than I am now. So I don't want to necessarily call her elderly. But she is clearly, you know, where Powell is the devil, she's an angel. She has, I think, three or four other foster kids that are with her, and she takes the two of them in because she sees how you know, just bad they're in, you know, what bad shape they're in. She has them cleaned up. She's feeding them. She takes them right into a house and basically assumes the stepmother or the foster mother role for them. And clearly she's a very strong woman because ultimately she's their savior. So I really loved her character and how she's played in this.
Lillian Gish asked the director why he wanted her for the part. And he replied, "When I first went to the movies, they sat in their seats straight and leaned forward. Now they slump down with their heads back and eat popcorn and candy. I wanted them to sit straight up again," you know, saying that she was going to be that compelling presence that brought them back in there. I thought it was such a great line and such a great reason for having her in the film. He talk about a sequence where they world builded with her. The whole sequence with Ruby, I think, is really important because of the fact that it shows that she is raising these kids. They aren't just living there. She is dealing with the fact that these are kids that have a tough life and are kind of involved in some shenanigans. And she does not dismiss Ruby when Ruby goes through her roller coaster. She embraces her and tries to understand her and encourage her and guide her so that way she's got a better chance at a better life. I really liked the character of Ruby and how we start to believe in this woman who we see in a much later portion of the film, but has to be critical in this because she turns into the hero of the movie. And if you don't believe in our hero, and you mentioned her being the light and being the good guy of all this, if we don't believe her in that light, we're not rooting for her to be the one. We're still rooting for John to be the one to take this guy down. You've got to shift to wanting her to be the one to do it. You want to shift to her being the one to save the kids in the long run, to set the kids on a better path. And I thought the film did an appropriate amount of time of giving her enough backstory, enough foundational piece. And sometimes that gets lost in these films where she could have been very shallow of a character. She was not. This film really gave an appropriate amount of real estate to the right characters in order for us to, I think, as viewers, believe in them. I wanted her to be the one to get them, and I'm glad that she did.
and she is the way she's portrayed in this, and I'm sorry, I gotta just backtrack a little bit. You mentioned Ruby, and Ruby is the older girl that's being fostered by her, and she ends up being manipulated by Powell to find out where these children are. So there's a couple of things going on there that I think are worth mentioning. First of all, it still shows you the relentless nature of Powell, how he just keeps coming and coming and coming. Despite these kids, you know, they when they finally escape him, they get in a boat and they go along the river, and they're just, you know, apparently days go by and he's still just coming. And there's a scene there, and you mentioned it's striking, where they show him on a horse and he's in the distance and he's you know, shadowed. And it brought to mind the Bible passage where they say, "Behold the pale rider," whatever, you know, and he who sits upon him is death, something along those lines. I may be misquoting the Bible there, but that's the feel it gives. And I'm pretty sure that's the feeling Lawton wanted to give. So he just keeps coming. And then you have this character of Ruby, who is, you know, probably, what do you figure she's supposed to be, about 15 maybe? And she goes to town and she's talking to boys and she's talking to him. And I think he buys her a soda and he just starts talking to her. And he ends up getting the information from her. And then she comes back and she talks to Rachel, who is Lillian Gish's character. And she's basically, you know, she's feeling guilty about what went on and all of that. And Lillian Gish just has such a motherly presence about her that, you know, she doesn't just yell at her for whatever she did. She's understanding. She moves forward. So the characters are all just, they really feel, even when they're small in this movie, they feel very well fleshed out. And I think that's just another thing to give Lawton credit for.
Adding to the creep factor of Powell, she's infatuated with him, Ruby. It feels inappropriate. It looks inappropriate, and he uses it to his full advantage, to the point later on when things go where they do with him, she's still like infatuated with him at that point in time as they're walking away. You know, she's still questioning what's happening to this man. And it's that added to the creep factor of him, just almost like you could see this guy starting a cult somewhere.
Well, it shows the creep factor, but it also shows how charismatic he is.
Yes. Yes. I agree. Oh, I think it all goes together.
Yeah. If he wasn't so charismatic, he wouldn't be as creepy because he would just seem villainous and that's it. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he's compelling as a preacher and as a storyteller and as a, you know, just a presence, that makes him more creepy because you see the influence he could have and the effect that he has on people. And then, you know, you see his motivations, which are, you know, complex in and of themselves. So there's again, a lot of layers to this. The score in this is interesting. I thought the music itself is very good. It just kind of emphasizes scenes and all of that. But I think the score is overshadowed by the villainous nature, or the ominous nature is probably a better way to put it, of Robert Mitchum singing his prayers, or whatever you want to call them, and just, it really just goes to kind of emphasize that inevitable, that he just keeps coming and coming, the relentlessness of him, and it becomes more and more chilling as it goes on.
I thought the score worked the best during the boat sequence, where the kids are stopping off at multiple places. They're on that escape journey, because there's not a lot of dialogue during those sequences. There's appropriate dialogue, but there's certain sequences where you needed the score to give you that sense of sound, that sense of energy that was needed there. And I thought it did a really good job during that sequence. It felt like I referenced some adventure shows and things like that that I loved. I felt like it gave me that sense of I'm on an adventure with these kids, where I want them to escape, and there's a thrilling escape moment going on. I thought the score worked really well in that sequence. The rest of it, though, to me, you're right. Him singing when he rolls into town or is chasing them. I think the most creepy thing is the way that he went outside her house when the kids are living with the foster, you know, home, and he's outside that house. At this point, the jig is up. They know he's bad. he knows they know he, you know what he's coming there for. He's like, I'm going to come back when it's nighttime. He's outside there singing. And I love that she eventually joins in and sings like almost like at him. You know, it's almost like dueling banjos between the two of them, where she's singing from the light, he's singing from the dark. And I thought that was incredibly effective. Letting him sing at first, building the creep factor, and then her pushing back. And I just thought, I thought that was a really neat use of music, and having the actors really kind of take the center stage with that, because that was really, that worked really well and wouldn't have if they hadn't established throughout this film how creepy he is when he rolls into town with that singing.
So I just would note, you mentioned Roger Ebert, what he wrote about it, and I'm just going to read that. He wrote, "What a compelling, frightening and beautiful film it is, and how well it has survived its period. Many films of the mid-1950s, even the good ones, seem somewhat dated now. But by setting his story in an invented movie world outside conventional realism, Lawton gave it a timelessness. It is one of the most frightening of movies, with one of the most unforgettable of villains. And on both of those scores, it holds up well after four decades." Film critics have noted that the film explores the theme of Christian hypocrisy, highlighting that Lawton was drawn to the script because he was gay and closeted and was critical of religious homophobia and sexual repression. And when you look at it from that perspective, you could say, yeah, okay, that might be his motivation in presenting this movie and the way, you know, in the way he did. But what it was just so good. I don't know where else to go with it except for so good. You know, just the other thing I just wanted to make mention, the last thing in my notes was, we've talked recently about colorized movies. Mm-hmm. Colorizing this movie would diminish it greatly.
Yes.
Lawton makes such good use of the black and white in this, and it's so moody and so just so the dark themes of it are all emphasized by the black and white, and they would be lost if you just brightened it in any way. So I am definitely not a pro colorization in all all situations kind of person.
Yeah, that when you see him in the distance, you know, I referenced that sequence very early on in the beginning, and you see him roll into town, you see her underwater, you see them on the boat, and strolling into these farms, you know, and just finding places to hide and escape and somehow rest. All of that is just so wonderfully crafted. When you think of the set pieces themselves, I think sometimes set pieces hold up so well in black and white. I did reference earlier the fact that he was a live theater person. You know, that was his thing. I think the changing sets really kind of show his strengths in theater, if that makes any sense. And I really loved the way that set pieces were used in this to build this overarching world. I think you're right. This is one I would have, I guess if they did colorize it, or if it has been colorized, I'd probably watch it just from an interested standpoint to go, was it effective? Did they manage to make that work? I don't know how you give up the tone and the lighting choices that were made in this one, because man, this is a stunning movie. you said it before multiple times, and I just want to echo it. It is so sad that this was his only movie as a director, because man, this is out of the gate.
You can only imagine what he could have done given more time to kind of hone his art.
Yeah.
I get the feeling he would have had multiple classics. You know, looking back at this movie, I am so glad that I had my little mission to check out stuff that I hadn't seen before, because this was a gem, no question. I can't gush enough about this. This is Jaws. It's that simple. This is, I think, it's just a real, real shame that this movie didn't get the acclaim it deserved when it was first out. That's the only thing I could say.
I saw this deliberately again last night because I didn't want to leave it to one viewing because I was Jaws after the first viewing, but I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't because this was this lost gem and I was, you know, overinflating it, if I'm making any sense. I went back through again and I loved it more. Like you said, you've watched it three times. My second time through, I loved it more. I do think it's a film that, first of all, it is Jaws. And I think if you're listening to this, this is a thriller. If you haven't seen it and you just listen to our commentary on this, even though we've revealed a lot of what happens in the film, you've got to see the execution of this. I think it's just one of those films that is got to be experienced. The performances have got to be experienced. This is a very special movie. There wasn't a wasted sequence. There was nothing I would have taken out of this film. And there's also not anything that was missing where I felt like, wow, this film would be so much better if they put this scene in or they added this. It was a great use of time. This film flows very well. There was nothing more I wanted from it and nothing I wanted removed from it, which is unusual. You know, there's usually something in a film where you're kind of like, you could take out this little sequence, or it would be so much better if you added this piece in there, or a little more exposition on these characters. I think, my gosh, for a first directorial debut, and whatever the editing looked like for this film, the pacing of this was phenomenal. I mean, it's just a really good movie. It cooks. It really, really cooks. This is one, if you didn't see it, you need to see it. I'm glad you suggested it. I thought this is part of the fun of doing this podcast, is that every so often we come across a film. This for me was one I would have not seen otherwise. And I'm so glad it did.
And I think what you say is borne out a little bit by the fact that what you say as far as, you know, the spoilers we've given you here, not impacting it, it's borne out by, upon repeated viewings, we thought more highly of it. So knowing what was going to happen did not take away from the enjoyment of watching this movie.
I agree.
So I would definitely recommend this to anyone. You know, sometimes you go into age groups. Obviously, it's not a children's film. And I don't think a young child or even an adolescent would probably appreciate the subtleties of this movie. I'm thinking this is a movie, you know, not that there's anything graphic in it that would prevent you from watching it beforehand, but I think unless you're a late teen or older, you probably wouldn't appreciate what was going on in this movie. That's my thoughts about it.
A high school or college film class, this would be a great film to put in there. Just Absolutely. As far as potential sleeper hits to throw in, just because I think this is a masterclass in filmmaking. And this is one that I would have appreciated in high school. A lot of my love for film, I've referenced it on this show multiple times, came from my high school film class. This is one that I wish would have been on the docket then, because I think I would have viewed it differently in high school in a good way. And I enjoy it in a different way now that I'm much older. And so this is, great film for a lot of different purposes. But I think you're right. The age range where you start, I think maybe that high school age where you're just getting into film and kind of exploring, I think this would be a great film to take a look at for film history.
And there's certain movies. I'm going to use Citizen Kane as my example, because that was often touted as the best film of all time. And from a cinematic point of view and watching it from, you know, you say like a masterclass in filmmaking, I think Citizen Kane fits that role. But from a compelling, I want to see this movie point of view, I always felt Citizen Kane was ranked too highly because it's just not something where I kind of, you know, where the story, I do get engrossed in the story, but I don't love the story. This movie, while it's a masterclass in filmmaking, it's also engrossing. It pulls you in and you get into the story. I remember when I took my first college filmmaking class, the professor had been on this. He had been on part of the crew. I have no idea what role he played, but he had been on the movie Goldfinger when it was made. And he showed the scene in Fort Knox to the class, and he showed how they put it together. And he implored the class beforehand. He said, "You're going to want to just watch this and enjoy it just from a, you know, just from an enjoyment point of view. But I'm asking you to try and keep yourself removed and watch it from a filmmaking point of view." I think this movie has the same risks to it. If you're watching it as a filmmaking point of view, you're still going to get pulled in by the story, and you're going to just you know, those filmmaking things that are in there are going to feel more like they're influencing your watching ability and making it more enjoyable to watch, more so than saying, hey, well, how did he do that? Or why did he do that? Because you're just going to get pulled in. And that's the kind of movie this is. And I just think it just couldn't be better.
Agreed. 1,000%. Thanks again. I want to thank you personally, because if you hadn't caught this one and said, hey, I think you should watch this, it might be something worth talking about, we wouldn't be here right now enjoying this film. So I'm glad that you thought this was something that was worth throwing on the list.
And I'm glad I gave it the shot myself. So we both win. And I hope the listeners of this show who have not seen it, watch it, and I think they'll win as well. And if you do, if you watch this at our suggestion and you have an opinion on it, whether you agree with us or disagree with us, I would love for you to send us an email or contact us on the Jaws Facebook page. But the email is jawspodcast@gmail.com, and I definitely welcome opinions on what you think of the movies that we cover. And we also welcome reviews on whatever podcast platform you use to download or listen to us, because first of all, they feed my ego, which is nice, and second of all, they hopefully put it out there for people to find the show, which is also nice. So thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Sean, for covering this with me, and we'll see you next time. Bye bye.
And I was sitting idly at home, and on a Sunday afternoon the telephone rang. And I picked it up and answered it. The voice said, Albert, it's Charles Lawton here. He said, I have a book that I'm sending over to you. He said, this is the most despicable character. He said, totally unredeemable. He said, a thorough villain. And I said, present. So he became involved with casting. And in the discussion, I asked about Rachel, and he said, Lillian Gish. And I said, but Charles, she belongs as a decoration on top of the Christmas tree, you know. She has a fragility, and she smiles like an angel. He said, I'll show you fragility. So he took us down to the studio, and he ran way down east, and she's on an ice floe. And as far as I can recall, it looked like, to me, like the Niagara River. In the next shot is Niagara Falls, and then she's on it. I mean, there's no photo magic there at all. And she either has to, unless they've got a rope stretched across to catch her by the neck, she's going over the falls. And that's not the sort of thing that I would do. And I was impressed. And she arrived. And she was the essence of grace. And she did smile like an angel. She was the cement that held the whole thing together. And it is a film that is seen forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And it is due in great part to the grace and that inner fiber of steel which lies within the character of Miss Gish.